The Democratic presidential debate, the last before voting begins in this year's contest. A closer look at whether the candidates were speaking to Texans today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown of the Texas Standard Newsroom. We'll explore whether anything in last night's debate might have made a difference to voters in the Lone Star State. Also, wage violations, a new law likely to insulate some of America's biggest franchises, and a unique way of talking among many Texans. Has Spanglish become a language all its own? All those stories, plus a PolitiFact check and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets rolling. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 15th day of January. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Think for a moment, if you will, about what's been making front page news over the last several days. Killing of an Iranian general by a U.S. drone, threats of retaliation, the accidental downing of a Ukrainian jet, and, of course, there's the impeachment process moving forward. Earthquakes in Puerto Rico leaving many of our fellow Americans homeless and without power. Now, let's fast forward to last night and the final debate among Democrats in the running for the White House before the first votes are cast in that contest. How much of the current national conversation was part of last night's back and forth? How much did the debate reflect the here and now? Moreover, was anything said that might move the needle in the party's push to topple Donald Trump come election time? Among the many Texans tuning in last night, one with some finely tuned thoughts on the state of American politics right now, Sharon Navarro is a professor at the University of Texas San Antonio Department of Political Science and Geography. Professor Navarro, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
My pleasure.
What did you hear as the main issues that the candidates took up? It seemed like a lot of people were focused on a little bit of back and forth between a couple of the top contenders.
Right. They tried to keep it interesting at the very least, but for the most part, I think we saw some temperament, which we seem to see lacking in the current administration. A lot of the candidates up there last night showed great temperament towards each other. In terms of the issues, I think one that hits home for Texas is trade with Mexico. Mexico is Texas's biggest trading partner. It accounts for about 35% of the state's exports. And so what the current administration is doing in terms of trade agreements would affect Texas. And we saw a little bit of what they thought were important to them as candidates.
To be honest, as I heard them talking about that, it didn't seem like they were making a stark contrast with what the president, President Trump has put out there. And I wonder, and this has been something of the tone of the commentary since last night's debate, it didn't seem like there was a real effort to take on Donald Trump as much as, say, for instance, the attention given to Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, the alleged conversation he had with her over whether or not a woman could beat Donald Trump, right?
Correct. That has long been the discussion of any candidate that runs for the presidency. You have to remember that when we think of the presidency and the institution itself in Texas, we tend to think of it as a masculine institution. And so it's difficult for us to break down these built-in historical stereotypes of anyone else but a white male. And so to hear that is new in this cycle of elections, but it isn't new in terms of what we saw in 2016 with a woman getting the nomination of one of the two major parties.
So do you think either of the two candidates, Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, came out stronger last night as a result of that back and forth? I mean, Sanders sort of said, no, I did not say what I'm alleged to have said.
No, I think it was just an interesting topic that was arisen, given that we have two females in the last debate before the Iowa caucus.
I don't like this question, but I'm going to ask it nonetheless because it's one that is always asked. Was there a winner in last night's contest as you saw it?
Only in the eye of the beholder. Anytime you look at these kinds of debates, any person's candidate that they support and they visually see in that debate is the winner. In other words, these kinds of debates only attract those who are interested in their candidates. So if their candidate, they see their up on the stage last night, they're going to say their candidate win. But what was clear is that these candidates, whichever one Iowa picks, has the temperament at this point to be presidential. And I think that was the point that we saw last night. Can these candidates that are running for president draw a stark contrast in terms of temperament, diplomacy, potential diplomacy? And we got a sneak peek of that last night.
How much does it matter? You talk about the eye of the beholder. Something that was hard to miss was the lack of diversity on that stage. The remaining group, among that remaining group, do you think there's anyone there who seems to be speaking to Latino voters, to voters of color?
Well, that's interesting. What we've heard first, and I don't think we've ever heard from any candidate up until last night, was Elizabeth Warren actually mentioning brown people or Hispanics in her speeches. And I think that was obvious as soon as former Mayor Julian Castro endorsed Elizabeth Warren. Prior to that, she never really spoke about brown people. And here, the last night of the debate, or the last debate, we hear her speak of that. So there was some influence of Julian Castro's endorsement of her. Now, whether or not that's going to translate into any actual substantial support from his constituency is another issue.
Do you think this, I mentioned the phrase, move the needle. What was the needle moved as a result of what happened last night?
No, I don't think so. It probably received the lowest viewership. We haven't seen the numbers yet. But it's, again, only of interest to the Iowans at this point.
Sharon Navarro is professor at the University of Texas San Antonio Department of Political Science and Geography. She watched last night's debate. Professor, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to share your thoughts with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Moving from the Democrats to the GOP, there are few, if any, races anywhere in the U.S. with a bigger field of Republicans in the running than the contest for Texas 22, the 22nd congressional district that brackets Houston from Fort Bend County to southeast Harris County. Long a Republican stronghold, incumbent Pete Olson is retiring, and as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider tells us, a lot of people nationwide interested in where this story is going to wind up.
This March, Republican primary voters will have their pick of 15 men and women to take Pete Olson's place. That all but guarantees the top two vote-getters will go to a runoff election in May. Right now, though, the top candidate to watch is probably Fort Bend County Sheriff Troy Nails.
If you look at the makeup of Congressional District 22, 70% of the votes come out of Fort Bend County. About 20%, 22% come out of Missouri, and then there's about 9% out of Friendswood.
Nails is the only Fort Bend County office holder among the candidates, which he believes gives him an organizational edge. Ask Nails what he thinks is the most important issue in the campaign, and he doesn't hesitate.
What I see is Washington's unwillingness to help the people in this district. The broken immigration laws is a prime example.
Nails is running on a pledge to crack down on illegal immigration, which he blames for human trafficking, drug trafficking, and much of the violent crime in the district. That's despite multiple studies that show illegal immigration doesn't increase violent crime. Nails says Congress needs to secure the southern border.
And now President Trump is trying to do it on his own by building that border wall, which I support that border wall. I truly do, a big, beautiful wall. And we want beautiful gates on it, because this isn't about legal immigration. This is about illegal immigration.
Kathleen Wall, a major Republican donor and former candidate for Texas' 2nd Congressional District, has taken a similar position, as she states in her ad.
I'll protect the sovereignty of our country by building a wall.
Immigration is far from the only issue for the field. Former Brazoria County Court Judge Greg Hill is primarily concerned with flood infrastructure and transportation.
The district itself, that we have issues as it relates, and really for the most part the region too, we have issues as it relates to flooding. And quite frankly, that's the reason why I think it's important to have a U.S. congressman that works to bring money home to the district on those sorts of issues.
Flooding's also a top concern for Pierce Bush, grandson of President George H.W. Bush and nephew of President George W. Bush. But even he's finding it hard to avoid immigration as an issue. The younger Bush is CEO of the nonprofit Big Brothers Big Sisters Lone Star.
It's clear We have a broken immigration system. I have seen in my experience leading the nation's largest one-to-one mentoring agency here in this family, I have seen families torn apart by the violence and the evil of drugs and drug cartels that are exploiting our poorest southern border. We have to stop that.
This is a district largely crafted by and for former Congressman Tom DeLay. One might expect a hardline stance to be a must here. But Craig Goodman of the University of Houston, Victoria, says what works in the March primary might no longer guarantee a win in November.
You've seen a dramatic decrease, for example, you know, in the Republican vote share in the district more generally.
The district is now a lot more diverse than it used to be. More than a quarter of the population is Hispanic. Nearly a fifth of the population is Asian, and many of those residents are immigrants or the children of immigrants.
You know, the Republican candidates are going to tie themselves to President Trump and try to ride his coattails, but I think this is a district where that could be a very dangerous game if you want to win.
Republicans have regularly won this district by double-digit margins. Pete Olson won re-election here in 2018 by just 5 percentage points. As an open seat, the margin could be even closer. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
Let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, find out what Texans are talking about on this Wednesday.
Hi, David. Sticking with national politics a bit longer, we're hearing from our friends and listeners about last night's Democratic political debate. Via Facebook, Dallas Hall said this about the Democratic presidential contenders. I thought Pete Buttigieg did pretty well. Janice Hitchcock felt that Joe Biden was fumbling and that Trump would run him over in a debate. Not as much reaction to what was expected to be a big moment, that tension between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Our commentator Janice continues that Warren pointed out that the women on the stage, herself and Amy Klobuchar, were the only ones that had never lost an election. Well, speaking of national politics, Nancy Pelosi naming 7 managers to oversee the House's impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate, and a Texan among them, Texas Representative from Houston, Sylvia Garcia, one of those impeachment managers. Many more reactions coming in about the House sending its impeachment resolutions over to the Senate. I know NPR is going to have some special programming on that today, but we have lots of comments as well. Be back with those later in the show.
What do you think, Texas? Well, you know what to do, right? You go on your social media platform of choice, you look for Texas Standard, and then you let us know what you think. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is looking for you, and he's going to be joining us once again in about 35 minutes or so with more of the talk of Texas as the Texas Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU, with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On.
Hi, it's Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Less than 48 hours after Iran hit 2 military bases in Iraq in retaliation for the U.S. killing of Iran's Revolutionary Guards leader, hundreds of high school students coincidentally converged in San Antonio for a Model United Nations conference. Students in charge of organizing that conference told Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips that the situation with Iran feels personal for them and their friends.
Matzah 24 is now open.
18-year-old Elias Hansen is the secretary general of the conference this year. As students filed out of the opening ceremony, the high school senior said his first reaction to the news of Soleimani's death was shock and fear.
Especially with this happening, not even in Iran, I was looking for justification. While some people felt that there already was some, I remember feeling like this is something that puts so many, not just American lives in danger, but innocent lives overseas in danger, and I was shocked and very scared, obviously, very scared.
18-year-old Elizabeth Polhamis said her first reaction was anger.
At the root of that, we're scared. I have a brother who could get drafted. I have close friends who could get drafted. And I just worry about the mental impacts of war on everyone, because it's not these politicians that are going to war. Donald Trump is not going to go to war.
Like Hansen, Polhamis is a senior at the International School of the Americas and one of the conference leaders. They say the news of the past week or so has felt different than any news they've had before, even after President Trump went on national television to de-escalate tensions.
I don't think we've ever had something that we talked about that felt so real and so close to home.
Pohemis and her classmates are too young to remember the terrorist attacks on 9/11. She says this feels like the scariest geopolitical event of their lifetime so far. Back at the opening ceremony, Hansen says everyone his age has talked and worried about the draft all week.
I know that a draft isn't going to happen, but I mean, a few months ago I got my Selective Service letter. It brings it back down to earth, like, oh my gosh, these are real people. They're going to have to face these consequences.
Because if we do go into some more active conflict, it's your generation that's going to really be impacted.
Absolutely. I mean, I have friends, a classmate of mine, I mean, he enlisted in the Air Force a few months ago. And at that time, that seemed like a pretty safe decision. You know, he was going to get free education. He had his life pretty much set ahead of him. And now he's thrown into a spot of complete uncertainty and almost regret because he did something that he thought would benefit his future. And now he's in a situation that it could really harm and maybe even shorten his future.
Hansen says he's relieved the immediate threat of war with Iran seems to have died down. But he and his friends know too much about global affairs to breathe a sigh of relief just yet.
Looking back at history, that's how wars start. A small spark like that, and I mean, that wasn't even something small. That was an extremely large action. And I think it's a general consensus around people my age that even though this was an enemy of the United States, this action is really putting a lot of lives in danger.
And they don't see that risk going away anytime soon. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you were listening to the Texas Standard. Over the weekend, the U.S. Department of Labor issued a new rule that will make it harder for employees of a franchise to sue over wage law violations. Labor Secretary Eugene Scalia argued that the new rule was an effort to roll back what he called intrusive regulations and to promote economic growth. So, what exactly does this rule do? For more on that, we're joined by Bill Beardall. He oversees the Worker Rights Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law in Austin. Professor Beardall, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Before this new rule was announced on Sunday, what course of action was available to employees of a franchise who felt they had a legal wage dispute?
Well, this applies to all franchise workers and subcontract workers and so forth. Basically, the Fair Labor Standards Act is the main federal law that requires minimum wage overtime pay for workers and restricts child labor. The Department of Labor issues the rules for interpreting this central federal wage law. For over 70 years, the courts and the federal government have said that where a big company subcontracts out to a subcontractor or franchisee or staffing agency to hire and oversee the workers who produce the big company's product or services, then the big company is still jointly responsible legally to make sure those workers get paid properly, at least where the big company keeps significant control over the subcontractor or franchisee.
But that has changed as a result of this rule change?
Well, so what this new regulation does is it undoes the traditional wage protections by now allowing companies to subcontract out their company's work to subcontractors or franchisees, and then to ignore wage violations that were suffered by the workers who perform that work.
The new regulation,
in essence, lets the big company say, oh, well, those are not our employees. They're the subcontractor's employees or the employees of the franchise. So we've got no legal responsibility for those wage violations.
This is something that corporations have wanted for some time. Labor groups and unions obviously don't like this change. But I want to get back to other ways that this could be implemented. For example, if there were a requirement for insurance for some of these franchisees, some of these local operations, wouldn't you accomplish the same thing? You'd still be able to achieve some kind of redress. Does it really matter that you can sue the papa franchisor?
Well, the reason this rule, and it's called joint liability or joint employer responsibility, the reason it is basically fair is that the workers essentially are part of the production process or the service delivery of the bigger company. So it's fair that the workers who are producing that product or service ought to be able to look to the big company for whom they're working for proper wages. And as your question anticipates, in many cases, it's really necessary to hold the big company jointly responsible because it turns out the subcontractor or the subfranchisee is now insolvent and can't pay, or because the subcontractor or franchisee is not really getting enough money from the big company to be able to fully pay their workers what the law requires. Or often that subcontractor or that subfranchisee just doesn't have enough independent authority or economic control to change the wage and employment practices without the approval of the big company.
So it is it your concern that with this rule change, there won't just be, a passive lack of justice? What I guess I'm really asking is that there is the prospect, or is there the prospect of this rule actually being abused so that people will be paid lower wages than they're entitled to?
Yeah, I think we can say there's not merely the prospect, there's a history. The whole reason this rule was evolved, mostly by the courts and ratified by the Congress, was that there was a history from the very beginning of the Fair Labor Standards Act, that is our federal wage law. From the very beginning, there was and has been a history of employers trying to evade the wage requirements by claiming, oh, those workers were not my employees, they're the employees of a franchisee or a subcontractor or somebody else. This rule of joint responsibility was devised precisely to prevent that kind of evasion.
Bill Beardall oversees the Worker Rights Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law in Austin. Professor, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Houston Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia is one of seven Democrats managing the case against President Donald Trump during his impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi this morning announced Garcia and the other lawmakers were chosen for their legal expertise.
The emphasis is on litigators. The emphasis is on comfort level in the courtroom. The emphasis is making the strongest possible case to protect and defend our Constitution, to seek the truth for the American people.
The U.S. House is expected to vote this afternoon to send the two articles of impeachment to the Senate. Texas is poised to carry out the first execution in the state and the nation this year. 64-year-old John Gardner is set to be put to death tonight for fatally shooting his wife Tammy Gardner in 2005. Robert Dunham with the Death Penalty Information Center says Texas has carried out more executions than any other state.
There have been 1,512 executions so far since the death penalty came back in the United States in the 1970s. 567 of those, that's about 38%, have been in Texas. And it's gotten even more disproportionate recently. Over the course of the last 5 years, Texas has carried out 49 executions, and that's 42% of all the executions in the entire country.
Seven other executions are scheduled in Texas through May. Houston startup companies are attracting more venture capital. Houston Public Media's Florian Martin reports the city is increasingly appealing to investors.
Venture capitalists invested more than $600 million in Houston-area startups last year. That's up from about $460 million in 2018. That's still a far cry from cities like San Francisco, Boston, New York, or even Austin, but it shows Houston is making progress in its quest to improve its startup and innovation culture.
That's Florian Martin reporting. The Texas Department of Family and Protective Services is rolling out new internal guidelines this week aimed at reducing the number of foster children certain frontline staff work with at a time. The state agreed to the standards last month. It was part of a deal between Texas officials and plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit that found long-term foster care in the state unconstitutional. Kate Murphy is with Texans Care for Children, a statewide advocacy group. She says reducing caseloads is a key step forward.
When Texas removes kids from unsafe homes and puts them in foster care, the kids often face a number of challenges, but when CPS foster care caseworkers have time to really focus on each individual child, they're going to be able to make sure that the kids in foster care have a more positive experience.
The caseloads for two types of caseworkers will range from 14 to 17 children. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Every year, an untold number of migrants attempt to cross the U.S. southern border without government authorization. The flow of humanity has been relatively persistent, even facing the possibility of imprisonment or death. People still come. Getting past the Rio Grande is not the only challenge. The harsh South Texas desert is also an unforgiving obstacle. The region is literally littered with the remains of people who didn't survive the voyage. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports on what he describes as the humanitarian crisis on the border.
Brooks County 911. Hello?
From the sweltering heat of the South Texas desert comes a call for help.
Hola. ¿Me puedo ayudar?
It's common for the Brooks County Sheriff's Department to receive 911 calls from migrants who are lost in the harsh terrain and are near death.
Como no hablé, Sonia, una muchacha me contestó. Después me pasó para otro.
This time, a group of migrants from El Salvador, who have been beaten down by the heat, dehydration, and exhaustion, are giving up on their American immigration dream. They want the Border Patrol to come and get them. But where are they in all that scrub brush acreage? They don't know.
No mira la dirección. No, no hay dirección.
They look for clues, and the 911 operator tells them that help is coming, but it's going to be a while.
Bueno, ahí quédese y llame para atrás por unos 30 minutos, ¿okay?
As the call ends, the woman expresses how hopeless she is and that she expects to die there.
Ay, ya no aguanto. Aquí nos vamos a morir.
Brooks County is about 70 miles north of the Mexican border. This is where the Border Patrol strategically stationed a checkpoint on Highway 281 at the town of Falfurrias. For migrants looking to enter into the interior of the U.S., they know that they must avoid that checkpoint to evade capture. So off they go, on foot, into the thorn brush desert.
It could be as far south as 50 miles away, or it could be real close to the checkpoint. And this heat and this weather, it gets pretty serious.
Eddie Canales is with the South Texas Human Rights Center.
They're crossing through thick brush, mesquite, cactus, and then underneath is sand. Walking through sand is difficult.
It's so difficult that many die. In 2019, over 30 human remains were discovered in Brooks County alone. That number is down from previous years. Over the last 10 years, though, it's estimated that 700 people died crossing Brooks County. Most of those people never had their human remains recovered. Their bodies are left where their coyote guides left them because they couldn't keep up.
King Ranch, a lot of recovery here. These three ranches have the main areas where bodies are recovered and skeletal remains.
In the summer, the temperature is routinely over 100 degrees, and it's during the summer that Brooks County sees the most migrants. Canales' mission is to help the people who make that journey come out of the desert alive.
We've got over 170 water stations. You're trying to get water in between, water before and water afterwards. We'll never have enough. I don't want it too far off.
On this day, I'm with Canales as he builds a few more stations.
Help me build your water station.
And he checks on others to see if they need to be restocked with water jugs.
How's it look?
All gone.
Each water station consists of a big blue plastic barrel with the word agua painted on the side. Inside, there are gallons of jugs of water that are sitting on top of a crate.
The crate, so make it easier for people to pick up the water.
Canales says he rarely sees any of his water stations vandalized. More often, he has seen that people in the community actually add jugs of fresh water to the stations.
When you see people dropping a case of water into your water station, there is good faith.
On top of the water stations, there is a tall pole with a white flag that's whipped back and forth in the hot desert wind. And on the lid of each of the barrels, there are the GPS coordinates for that location. So if a group of migrants need to be rescued, they can call authorities and tell them exactly where they are, and the Border Patrol can pull them out of the desert while they are still alive. In Brooks County, David Martin Davies reporting.
David's reporting for the border continues tomorrow. On Saturday in Corpus Christi, Denton, Amarillo, San Antonio, and several other cities, women who identify as politically progressive plan to stage marches as a reminder of the political power of women voters. The nation's main march will be held in Washington, the fourth year for these women's march events, launched the day after the inauguration of President Trump as a protest. In 2017, some 35,000 people attended at a rally in Austin. But the Corpus Christi Caller Times reports that in years since, attendance has dropped off considerably. Stay tuned. Coming up on 39 Minutes Past the Hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown, and it is time for another edition of...
Texan.
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 Translation.
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 Texan.
Translation.
Our monthly look at Texas linguistics, wherein we break down the speech of one well-known Texan at a time, with Lars Henricks, a professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin, and the director of the Texas English Linguistics Lab. Professor, welcome back.
Thanks, David.
And we also have a special guest today joining us in the studio for reasons that will soon become clear, the Texas Standard's own Joy Diaz. Hey there, Joy.
Hey, David. Hi, Lars.
Hi, Joy.
So, Professor Henricks, who are we talking about this week?
Well, David, like you said, usually in the segment we talk about the speech of one prominent Texan, but today it's going to be a little different. We thought we're going to talk about a key aspect of the Texas linguistic landscape, Spanglish.
Whoa, okay, interesting. Spanglish. I think most people are probably familiar with Spanglish, at least as a term, but perhaps you should give us the technical definition here.
Okay, so it's not as easy to define as you might think. Spanglish obviously is some form of a mix of Spanish and English, but it's different from other ways that languages can be mixed. It's not your regular kind of bilingualism. So it's not just code switching. It's a special kind of linguistic practice that exists only in certain social spaces where there is a strong presence of the two cultures, like the southern border of Texas, where there is equal presence of both English-speaking culture and Spanish-speaking culture.
Joy, as someone who speaks both English and Spanish and is a Texan, does that definition make sense to you?
Yes, there's even a class now at St. Mary's University in San Antonio for Spanglish. And I know that purists are having heart attacks with it, but yeah, it does make sense.
So maybe we could present an example to illustrate this. Now, we all have kids, so let's take a sentence I'm sure we've all said from time to time. Where's your lunchbox? Now, Joy, how would you say that in Spanish?
Okay, so if I'm speaking Spanish, I would say, ¿Dónde está tu lonchera? But if I'm speaking like purest Spanish, I would say, ¿Dónde está tu caja de almuerzo?
Okay, got it. Now, what about in Spanglish?
Okay, so if we're rushing at home, I would say, ¿Dónde está tu lunchbox?
Oh, I like that. I like
with
that.
Snapping of fingers.
Yeah, clear difference here. So, Professor, what do you hear going on there?
So yeah, Spanglish is the least formal, the most real mixing of the languages. And "Dónde está tu lunchbox?" You have a code switch and a very tightly integrated form of the two languages. Although you still have like "Dónde está tu?" is pure Spanish, lunchbox is pure English. Mm-hmm. So it's not one of those forms that really only exist in those border regions. Mm. But it's already a very tight mix that's not purest to either language, right?
But lunchbox is, of course, an English word. And I understand that this convergence will sometimes give you words that are completely unique to Spanglish. Can either of you think of any examples?
For instance, biles, for paying bills.
Yeah, there's a one that you hear a lot is parquear, which is not a Spanish word. In Spanish, to park a car, you would use the verb estacionar, but parquear is using the English verb park with Spanish morphology, and it really only happens in places like the Valley and Laredo.
I understand that there's a phrase for "can I call you back," is that right?
Yeah, I think this is very unique, isn't it, Lars? Like "te llamo patras," which is something that you definitely would not find in Mexico City, for instance, but those of us who have been influenced by both languages, by English and Spanish, "te llamo patras" makes perfect sense. I'll call you back.
Yeah, but it shows how you need to know English to make sense of the Spanish phrase. It uses only Spanish words, but it has an underlying English kind of logic, the patras,
right.
meaning back. You have to kind of know at least a little bit of English to make sense of it. Purist Spanish speakers are not happy with this. I know quite a few couples in Austin where one speaker is from the border region, a Spanglish speaker, and the other person is from farther south in Mexico or even Latin America, mm-hmm. and they often have arguments about what proper Spanish is.
Well, now I can imagine that there are some instances where you could have some confusion between, you have both English and Spanish, you know, with idioms and words that sound like one thing but mean another. I think, what is that called, Professor? False cognates?
False cognates, yeah, or false friends. Words that look the same in both languages and are used as meaning the same, whereas they don't really in the standard languages. So there's, for example, "libreria" in Spanglish can mean library, but the actual Spanish meaning of "libreria" is bookstore.
Oh.
And for library, you would say in Spanish "biblioteca." Another good example is "recordar." In Spanglish, you can use "recordar" to mean record, when actually in standard Spanish, the word means remember.
Hmm.
And if you wanted to say to record in standard Spanglish, you would say grabar. They're visually similar, so they are used as being similar because there's such a strong presence of the other language that makes this happen.
Huh. Joy, have you ever encountered a misunderstanding by using Spanglish with a Spanish speaker?
Oh, have I ever? I have, but I think my sympathy goes to my dad because he was an English speaker in Mexico City and he was a minister. And one word that got him in trouble a lot was the word embarrassed, because embarrassed is very similar to embarazada. Embarazada means pregnant, and embarrassed, of course, means, you know, embarrassed.
Well, now here's a question for both of you. Would it be accurate to call Spanglish its own language? Maybe. Hmm. What do you think, Joy?
I am not a purist of languages, and I definitely embrace the fact that both Spanish and English are alive and evolving. And as a mother of two kids who are learning both languages, I have a lot of sympathy for this merger and a lot of sympathy for this, in a way, child that has evolved from these two languages. So I am in love with Spanglish.
Yeah, I totally get that. But
I know that not everybody is.
Lars, what do you think about the question of whether or not this could be its own language?
Maybe not yet. It's not defined enough, although there are a few terms that everybody will tell you are good examples of Spanglish, like Parquear and a few of those we've spoken about, but it's too fluid, and it's, I think you define it best as a practice, as a linguistic practice in a certain social space. For Spanglish to become a language, it would need a governing class that speaks it. You would need a governor or a president speaking Spanglish, and then very quickly it would become the norm, and you would have books describing how to speak Spanglish properly, and you know, it goes quickly. It's a political question whether something is a dialect or a language.
Well, something tells me we might get there faster than anyone imagines. You never know. We've been talking today with Lars Henriks. He's professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's the director of the Texas English Linguistics Lab. Professor, thanks a lot as always.
Thank you so much, David.
And we're also so grateful for the expertise of Texas Standard's own producer, Joy Diaz. Joy, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you both.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Democratic State Representative Gene Wu of Houston says that, quoting here, about a third of Texas has seen a 20 to 25% population loss in the last 5 years. Is that a fact? Madeline Meckelberg is here to look into it. She's with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Hello there.
Hey there.
I was thinking about this claim. I've been hearing all about Texas gaining a lot of folks.
That's right. That's why this claim caught our attention.
Okay.
It seems contrary to the narrative.
Where did it originate from?
So this was State Representative Gene Wu. He was sharing a tweet. He was providing a link to an NPR article, actually, about how the United States saw the slowest population growth rate in a century last year across the country. And as you mentioned, that's the opposite of what we've seen in Texas. We've seen the population growing. But when he was sharing the article, Wu said that he sees people constantly make arguments against immigration to suggest that, you know, we're full, don't come, things like that.
Uh-huh.
And he presented this statistic to make the argument that, actually, no, we're not. Even though you're hearing this narrative, look, population's going down, population's declining in Texas, even though we're hearing this narrative. And he said, as you said, about a third of Texas has seen a 20 to 25% population loss in the last 5 years.
So I know that reaching out to the speaker is part of your process for getting down to the bottom of things. What did he have to say about how he came up with this number?
So this is where I ran into a problem immediately. Wu was not entirely sure where this figure came from.
Oh.
So first thing he did was he sent me a map that he got during a hearing on redistricting that they've been having at the Capitol. And the map looked at the population of different state house districts. Texas has 150. And it compared the latest population estimates with the estimated ideal size for those districts based on the estimated population for the state. I know it's a lot to follow there.
Yeah, right.
And it measured the percent deviation between the actual population of these districts and the estimated ideal district size.
Okay.
So that's not at all speaking to population change over time, or anything like that. It's just measuring the difference between those two numbers. So I said that to him. I was a little confused.
Yeah.
And then he realized, you know, he said, oh, I sent you the wrong map. Let me see if I can track down the right one. He didn't have a copy that he could provide, so I was off to the races to find this data by myself.
You're trying to find data that will support what it is that he's said.
Right, and he wasn't able to provide me with that map.
Okay, so were you able to find any data that would back up his claim?
So I turned first to the Texas Demographic Center, which monitors this and publishes information.
Right.
They kind of digest those census numbers in an easy-to-understand way,
right,
which we like here.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found was, looking at the state's 254 counties, 87 saw a decline in population from 2013 to 2018.
See, that's what I figured.
Yeah, that's about one-third of the counties in Texas, if you're doing that math.
See?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
But the percent of that loss is much different than what Wu said in his claim. He said a third saw a 20 to 25% reduction in population.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, the largest decrease was in three counties. They each saw a decline of about 9%.
Oh.
From there on out, it was from 7% to a little less than 1%. When you look at the population of those counties altogether, so mm-hmm. all the counties that saw a decline, that decline was just a 2.8% decrease in population across all of those counties. So that doesn't come close to the figure that we got from Wu.
I see. So I guess it sounds like we're pretty close to ready for a ruling on this
I think
one.
We are, but yeah. I'd love to share some more information.
Well,
since,
I'll say something else for sure.
Since he said this claim came from a map in a redistricting hearing, we also checked out population changes within those state house districts that he was talking about.
You are thorough, aren't you?
I really am. Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying
yeah.
that. And of those 150 counties, just six saw a population decline in the last 5 years.
Wow.
And that is definitely not one third.
Okay, I think I know where this one's going. How does Gene Wu's claim come out on the Texas Truth-O-Meter?
We rated this claim false.
False. That state representative Gene Wu's claim that a third of Texas has lost 20 to 25% of its population over the past 5 years. That from the fact checkers at PolitiFact Texas, celebrating its 10th birthday this month. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm very excited. PolitiFact Texas turns 10. We're a couple years behind PolitiFact, which had its 12th birthday last year in August of 2019. We're one of about a dozen state affiliates of PolitiFact, and PolitiFact Texas was the first one. So,
awesome.
Woohoo.
Party at Madeline's house. No, I'm just kidding. Madeline Meckelberg's with PolitiFact Texas. See you next week.
See you then.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, who's got some of the talk of Texas right there in his hands.
That would be correct, David. As we noted earlier, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi naming the impeachment prosecutors in the case against President Trump in next week's expected Senate trial ahead of a formal vote to refer those charges to the upper chamber today. Mm. As you'd expect, folks sounding off on our Facebook page, Robert Flood says at points, President Trump has clamored for witnesses, and I think we all believe Trump should get what he wants. Robert says the nation should also be given a chance to hear what they have to say to put into perspective the actions and reactions of our governing leaders.
Hmm.
However, Val Bankston says, as an American taxpayer, I am tired of the wasted money that has been spent to no good end. We as Americans know what the Democratic Party fails to recognize, that conviction in the Senate won't happen. Move on, Val says. However, Tricia Humanville, she says they have honored the oath they took to protect the Constitution and the country, those Democrats who did vote for impeachment. It would be a dereliction of duty to not have such investigations. And as well, we mentioned earlier that Houston area Representative Sylvia Garcia, one of the seven managers named by
right.
Pelosi, yeah,
mm-hmm.
she shared some of her thoughts on Twitter. She said as much, honored to be one of seven House impeachment managers who will be making the case to the American people. For me, this is about upholding my oath of office. I take my responsibility seriously because we're working to defend our Constitution at a pivotal moment in our democracy. So, yeah, very interesting developments there, and
yeah.
interesting to see Texas represented among those impeachment managers.
I guess that's right. Of course, the two senators from Texas
yeah.
are still standing squarely behind President Trump right
Don't
now.
Don't see that changing anytime
yeah, that's,
soon.
That does not seem to be moving very much. Taking a look here, still mm-hmm. a lot of analysis about last night's debate. Did you watch the debate last night?
I saw bits and pieces, unfortunately, at bedtime. Not for me,
that's right.
wishfully, but it's, for
it
the,
was interesting.
For the younger
not,
ones.
Not so many people were covering it, I found, which I thought was a little curious, given that this was the last debate before mm-hmm. people actually start to cast ballots.
Yeah, like 2.5 weeks or so until
it's,
the Iowa
It's really
caucuses.
Coming up here, yeah. Another piece, this one in Politico, saying, young progressives mourn Bernie-Warren feud. And I think the image from last night that people seem to be sort of circling mm-hmm. around was this one where Bernie Sanders at the end is reaching out to shake Elizabeth Warren's hand. She's not having any
of it. A
little
bit of a standoff there at
yeah.
the end.
Yeah.
Interesting on Twitter, I noticed that weird thing on Twitter, this hashtag never Warren, as in Elizabeth Warren, was trending, but it seemed like the people sharing that hashtag most prominently were those who saying, hey, this whole hashtag never Warren thing is dumb. Why would you do that? But you have to ask yourself, why are they promoting the hashtag if they're in disagreement with it? You know, yeah. So that's a good example of how messages can get jumbled on social media. You know, we got a lot of messages to that in response to that fun discussion of Spanglish.
Oh, yeah.
From earlier in the show. Juan Carlos Martin, he shared some of his famous favorite Spanglish words, if you will, la yarda instead of the lawns, la carpeta instead of alfombra for carpets.
How
fun stuff like that. Lots more recommendations.
Yeah, keep those coming, would you? We're out of time for the big broadcast. We're going to be back here tomorrow. I hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm Dave Brown, along with the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.